You're listening to By the Well, a podcast for preachers with me, Robin Whittaker.
And me, Fran Barber. And today we're really fortunate to be joined by the Reverend Dr. Sunny Chen. Sunny is a New Testament scholar. He teaches Greek at Pilgrim Theological College and is currently in placement as a presbytery minister in metropolitan Melbourne. Welcome to By the Well, Sunny.
Thank you, Fran, and thank you, Robin, for your kind invitation.
Sunny, I'm just wondering how you approach preaching when you're asked to take a service in your role at the moment.
I think one thing that I really pay attention to is trying to keep the reflection a bit more interesting, because so many stories, for example, gospel stories, are so well known among so many people. So I try to find out something that would stand out that people usually overlook. So the first step I would go straight into, apart from reading, you know, the reading itself, I'll just go to the Greek New Testament and just go through the text carefully. And sometimes I would spot, you know, one or two quite fascinating stuff that even I myself have known the reading quite well, but have overlooked for years. And I was use that as a starting point. So use that as a base and do a bit of more research and study and then build it up as a reflection for my sermon.
Wonderful. Thank you. Well, today we're going to get a little bit of Sunny's style, and I have heard you preach, and you are a very engaging preacher, Sunny, as well as a scholar, which is why you're here. Today we're going to look at the gospel reading for this week, the 22nd Sunday after Pentecost, which is Matthew 23. But then we're going to turn our attention to the All Saints Day New Testament texts, because preachers have a choice on November the 1st this year whether to go with the All Saints readings or the traditional Sunday readings. So if you're going to go All Saints, you can fast forward through this first bit. But we're going to start with Matthew 23:1-12. And we're here in Matthew. We've had a chapter now of Jesus in Jerusalem in these increasingly tense conflict conversations with various Jewish leaders representing various parts of Judaism. And where we're going is a whole series of woes, so that the tension is high at this point. But Jesus starts here. He's addressing the whole crowd and his disciples. He's talking about the Pharisees and scribes, and has this reference to Moses' seat. Sunny, what is this? Would people have known what Moses' seat means? Because we often don't.
Yes, you ask a very good question. It depends on where you or how you see it. So I think some people would see Moses as, of course, you know, in the Exodus story, a leader, a God-chosen leader, almost like, you know, acting not just a leader, but also a judge. So people usually focus on that sort of the authority given, you know, a leader as a judge and so on and so forth. But when I sort of read this particular passage, something actually came to my mind. I'm not saying this is the interpretation, but just one of the angles that you can, you know, divert into. So it sort of connected to one of the readings that we have today in the lectionary, which is Joshua chapter 3. And if you pay attention to that reading, you know, the Lord actually saying to Joshua, today I will honor you. And I think a lot of people would know the story about Moses and Joshua. Joshua being a protege, you know, following Moses along the way and so on and so forth. So learning from Moses, the leadership. But I think one thing that a lot of people would overlook, and I find it quite interesting for reflection, is the question, who is Joshua? And most people say, oh, you know, he is a chosen person, a young guy initially, chosen by Moses as a student or as a protege. But if you pay attention to the story in a very meticulous way, Joshua actually comes from the tribe of Ephraim. So in that era, you know about the 12 tribes. Ephraim is one of the sons of Joseph, and the elder sonship actually passed to him. So there's a long story behind it. So that is actually the tribe as a leading tribe. So Joshua, of course, you know, by nature, so to speak, is the default leader that Moses, of course, would choose from the tribe. So that's the identity of Joshua. So my reflection on this, you know, is almost like a bit jumpy, but in a way, I think it's quite helpful, because as many of you would know that, you know, the name Joshua in Hebrew is exactly the name that we have in Greek, Jesus, Jesus, you know, that's a transliteration. you know, Yahweh saves, you know, that's the meaning of it. And of course, you know, we know from the story here, the struggle between the leaders, you know, the Pharisees and the scribes, especially against Jesus, is who's Jesus? You know, he's not from whatever tribe. So I think that this sort of tribal sort of reflection is quite interesting. Joshua coming from the default tribe, Ephraim, the leader. But Jesus not from Ephraim, he's from Judah. So I think, you know, my reflection on Moses' seed is not much about, oh, is it a judge? Is it a leader? It's really about the concept of leadership. And sometimes I believe God does choose people that out of people's expectation, you know, either I call by nature or nurture. Someone quite unexpected in many ways. And I think this is a reflection I have when I, you know, look at the word or the phrase Moses' seed.
Yeah, so it immediately takes us into this kind of a battle of leadership here. And Jesus has been doing all this teaching, but he's not an authorized teacher. He hasn't been trained in a Pharisaic school or any other tradition. And I think part of what we get in this passage is a contrast between leadership that seeks its own privilege and status, that kind of performs religion really well, but Jesus is critiquing, you know, is making it burdensome and you know, overlooking those who are struggling. And then towards the end of the passage, this kind of leadership that would be humble, that would seek to serve, we get the diakonos word here. But Fran, what were your reflections on Matthew?
Mine were really around the hypocrisy that Jesus is accusing the Pharisees of and around the vehemence of his criticism and about how that stands against or goes along with his command to love your neighbour as yourself or to indeed love your enemy. So he's really angry and not pulling any punches. And we've talked before about how Matthew's Matthew's understanding of the faith and of the commandments is that love comes first and they are to be interpreted through the lens of love. So my thoughts are around how you reconcile, I guess, how he's talking about the Pharisees alongside the main emphasis of Jesus' teachings. Yeah. And how we sit with love and judgment.
For me, it helps to also think of Matthew's community and the audience into which he writes, which is the other side of the destruction of the temple, maybe in the 80s or even 90s, depending where you date Matthew. But scholars, Matthean scholars do tend to talk about, you know, that we get in this text some evidence of a continued antagonism and conflict with, you know, between Jews who now think Jesus is the Messiah and Jews who don't, and that this is a major point of conflict. And part of this strong polemic and antagonistic relationship with the Pharisees, who were the group who came to the fore after the destruction of the temple in terms of the teachers of the law who carried on the tradition. So it probably reflects Matthew's community, perhaps more. It's not to say there's no historic kernel to these texts, but the level of conflict might speak to that later community, I think. I want to say too that, I mean, we've seen Jesus have conflict with different groups here. We need to remember the Pharisees and scribes are only one group within Judaism. So this is not, again, we've talked about this before, let's avoid the Jesus versus all Jews, as if all Jews were like this and Jesus is the exception, because this is one particular group with one particular approach.
But I think, yeah, indeed. I'm just thinking if you're moving a not when I say beyond the text, I don't mean that to sound as it sounds, but, you know, how are you going to talk about this with your community? And I think that whole thing around the visibility of how you show that you're faithful, and it actually, whereas we're in a culture now where it's quite odd to be Christian in most places, and so people tend to actually hide rather than display.
Certainly in Australia, I think, where we're quite non-religious or even anti-religious in some pockets. We don't perform our religiosity in the way that when I lived in America, people were far more open about talking about faith more generally. I think that's a really interesting point, Fran, because it takes us to perhaps a deeper meaning and away from just leadership, which might be more preachable, to a question of, you know, what really are the tangible expressions of faith And around the world right now, so many churches are being forced to worship and gather and meet and be church in ways that are completely different. We in Melbourne, we can't get into our buildings still. We can't even gather in groups of more than five. So I think it does beg some really basic questions of what does faith look like when you strip away the albs and the pews and the buildings and the stained glass and even the communion table and the font? And I'm not
and
saying
the open
those
door.
Aren't. And the open door.
Yeah, the open door. It's like at one level, it is more visible and available because it's online.
Yes.
And in a strange sort of way, it is, but not in any obviously an embodied physical way. You know, an open door says a lot of a church building and music and music and bells, if that's what church it is.
So I think it
I think it's quite relevant. Sorry, I was saying that it's quite relevant to the story too, because we are, you can say, at a juncture facing a huge transition. But I think it's exactly the same, you know, when the early church facing after the destruction of the second temple, you know, the transitioning from the center of the universe, so to speak, in Jerusalem. But now people had to worship, you know, in ordinary houses or in different places. So it's quite a big transition. I think, you know, the readings that we have, not just today's, but a lot of these sort of so-called ancient readings could be quite relevant to what we are facing too. You know, very similar, not in terms of the exact shape and form, but in terms of the transition, the huge transition that, you know, both are actually facing.
Yeah. I want to ask you, Sunny, about this love word, because we're going to see a lot of love in the All Saints readings, or at least one of them. I was struck, you know, when you are an academic and a minister, the verse 6, they love the places of honour, you know, the status. There is a sense that, you know, all of us can get a little tempted by those trappings. We like the accolades or people acknowledging our work or whatever it is. Can we say something about the love here and what this word might mean?
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, this is a very good starting point to talk about what I always want to say. First of all, you know, we see here, even the English translation, we have the word love. But you read the Greek text, is the word phileo. It's a verb, love, but you know, the noun form of it is philos. And a lot of people I've heard, you know, they talk about this particular meaning about phileo or phil, P-H-I-L, Philadelphia, for example, is kind of like relating to a friendship, which is true. Philos does carry that kind of a connotation. And phileo contains some kind of what I call, if you have a love speed, a bit of mutual attraction and love going on. I think the connotation behind it is really about enjoyment. So you read carefully, you know, this is what the Pharisees and the scribes really enjoyed. You know, they really enjoy showing off the whole thing. But I think the one thing that really annoys me is a lot of discussions or sermons or even during Bible studies, people will leap into comparing phileo, love, with the other very famous word, agape. And I have heard so many times that people saying agape, the love agape in the New Testament means God's holy unconditional love. And I think, you know, I normally would be very annoyed by it. I usually keep my mouth shut. And today I think it's a good opportunity for me to talk more about this word, because in 1 John chapter 3, we do have a very, I could say, famous passage, and it's about love. You know, it says, see, you know, an imperative, almost like, look, what kind of love of the Father has given us that we should be called children of God. And people zoom into it and look at the word, you know, love of the Father is agape. Now, I want to say something about this word, especially in 1 John.
Which, can I just say, 1 John 3 is one of the All Saints readings. So we're in All Saints Sunday territory now. Back to you.
Thank you, Robin. So a lot of people say, oh, we know the word love is very important, but is exceptionally important in 1 John. In fact, you count the occurrences of the word love, both agape and the verb agapao in 1 John. And I was actually quite surprised when I did some sort of research. In terms of comparing, you know, the frequency of the word, and of course counting the length of the letter, the verb love in First John is 8 times more than any other books in the New Testament. It's like huge.
It's massive. So, it's everywhere.
Yes, yeah. It's everywhere. It's exceptionally frequent. You know, you count the length of the letter, you know, comparing with the rest. So, for example, I'll give you some technical kind of thing. It's quite boring. You need to try to count the heat of the word per 1,000 word. Matthew, the gospel reading we have today is 0.44. But, you know, the verb love in First John is 13.08. It's like, it's a bit boring maths, but it's a lot.
Mm. And it's, sorry, Sonny, and it's that one, it's agapao that is
agapao is 8 times. If you look at the noun, agape is 3 times.
Okay.
More. Yep. It's a lot. It's really a lot. It recurs throughout the letter of First John.
I just wasn't sure where the phileo appeared as well.
I'm not so sure about that, but definitely agape and agapao is everywhere in First John. So if you don't mind, I want to venture into the meaning of agape. I remember a bit anecdotal a story, you know, way before I learned New Testament Greek. I was a new believer, you know, attending a church, a home church in Hong Kong. And I still remember the lesson taught by my pastor. You know, I really envy him, like, you know, he knew Greek so well. But he said to us, saying, it doesn't really matter about whether you know the original meaning of the word or original language. The most important bit is understanding the context. Mm-hmm. You never take a word out of the context to try to create some kind of meaning. It's dangerous. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to agape, and he showed me something fascinating. He actually used the example, which I'm going to share with all of you, John 3:16. For God so loved the world, you know, the verb agapao, which is, of course, a verb form of agape. And everyone would know, oh, of course, you know, agape, a holy unconditional love. And then my pastor said to us, like, you know, read further. Now, that's John 3:16, but just read on. So we continue the reading, and then we hit, you know, John 3:19. And the text says that people loved darkness more than the light. And all of a sudden, my pastor said, do you know what word love here is? Well, it says people love darkness. The same verb, agapao. Mm. So I think that was the first time I was exposed to a very important concept about word meaning. Mm. And we all know that 3:19 is not about holy unconditional love. No. You know, people love darkness more than the light, you know, alluding to Christ. So that's the first time I was exposed to this very helpful teaching. Mm. I think that's the encouragement to us all. It doesn't really matter whether we know the original language. Context is very important.
Yes.
But then when I went to the seminary to learn more about Greek, you know, I sort of, you know, I fell in love with the language. And I learned something quite interesting about the word itself. The first one, you know, of course, I was referred to a book written by D.A. Carson. A scholar is called, I think, talking about all the fallacy of word study. In the book, you know, he quoted an example quite helpful. He talked about the Septuagint, you know, roughly about 200 years before the first century. You know, a group of Jewish translators were commissioned to translate the so-called Old Testament from Hebrew to Greek Old Testament. And then, you know, Carson argued, if you pay attention to a story, a horrendous story in 2 Samuel chapter 13. It talks about one of the sons of King David called Amnon. Mm-hmm, and it's quite a horrendous story, how Amnon raped his half-sister. Mm. And in the story, you can see both the word agape and agapao to describe so-called love of that, you know, evil person.
Evil, yeah.
So I think, you know, Carson made a very clear sort of teaching about be very careful when you say agape actually means holy unconditional. Mm. Nothing holy. It's a selfish, possessive love.
Mm. And this is so helpful because I do remember, you know, very early on the kind of anyone who learned a tiny bit of Greek was told, well, agape means this kind of God's love, unconditional. Mm. Phileo means brotherly love. Eros is sexual love. As if they had these distinct, discrete meanings. And what you're saying is actually the way they're used in the Bible is so different.
Yes.
And we need to break that down.
Exactly. And I think context would tell you.
Yep.
And then my teacher, Dan Wallace, you know, shared with us a particular way to understand agape.
Yeah.
I find it quite helpful and fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said, you know, phileo is almost like, you know, the two parties or two persons getting a mutual love. Mm-hmm. So that's why friendship is a very good way to describe it. You know, there's a mutual attraction. Mm. But when it comes to agapao or agape, basically the word agape, the quality of the love is determined by the quality of the love or the lover, the one okay. producing the love, so to speak. So I think you look at John 3:16 and John 3:19, it makes sense now. God is so wonderful and generous and holy. The love that he would produce or express, of course, it would be wholly unconditional. Mm. But people, especially in the Gospel of John, it's very selfish, you know, who are the lovers of sin. Of course, the love that they express would be rejecting the light. So I think it's a, quite a helpful way to understand your word. Again, I think, you know, my pastor, even before the day I learned Greek, gave us such a good lesson. Context is so important, you know, just look carefully. I just want to make one remark, you know, I think, you know, helping people say, oh, agape not wholly unconditional. I think one of the reasons why we do have that meaning, because later on, you know, the early church, like the church fathers, when they were writing things and gradually they sort of, you know, adding a bit of meaning into it, and agape almost exclusively was reserved to describe this wonderful love of God. And for centuries, the word actually did mean that, you know, yes. But the word in the New Testament, exactly, is not. So I think that's my reflection.
That's helpful.
Yeah.
And, I mean, in this passage, I was struck by it too, because when you read it in the Greek, so the English in 3:1, 1 John 3:1, says, see what love the Father has. But actually in Greek, it's see what kind of love.
Yes.
It's about- I was going to mention that because Bentley Hart's translation has puts the what kind of.
Yes. And I mean, that's the same with the classic John 3:16, for God so loved the world. Mm. I use this with my New Testament classes all the time. It's God loved the world in this way. It's the manner of God's love. Yes. It's not God loved the world a lot.
Yes, so this is exactly.
So if we were preaching this text, and particularly with All Saints in mind, what is the what does this tell us about the nature and the kind of love that this author's talking about?
And can I interject? Sorry. And also, presumably, is the love that we're called to love our neighbour and to love our enemies. Because this word love is bandied around very frequently. God is love. It's come to be a short, it's a fantastic shorthand, but it can be trite, it can be trivial. So, can you fill it out a bit more?
I think, you know, the one way to look at what kind of love is a perfect example. Mm. The word love itself really doesn't tell you much about the quality. Mm. You have to look at the example in 1 John set by God himself. I think 1 John carrying the meaning about God sending his son is quite prevalent. Yep. So this is a way to learn about love. But there is another way that, you know, is being spelled out later on, you know, when you read the whole letter in one go and pay attention to the command of love, love one another being repeated. But I still remember one of the passages in 1 John talking about the actual way to express love and talking about if you see your brothers and sisters are having, let me paraphrase it, you know, material difficulties, so to speak. Then you shun your own heart, not doing anything. How could you say you love the God that is invisible? So I think this is a way to almost reflecting on how we preach. What kind of love? These are the examples. So I think this is a huge, you can say, quite a heavy, I would say heavy reflection on all of us. Sometimes we Christians like to use the word love in such a way that, oh, love, love, love. As if it's about some kind of either a fussy feeling or the bar is so high, it's so holy. But it's not true. It is not how love being portrayed in 1 John. In a way, it's very concrete. And I love the notion about love is about action. Love is not just about a feeling or some kind of a religious sentiment. It's talking about when you see people who are in need, this is how you expect that kind of love. You know, you sacrifice yourself. I think that is quite helpful when you look at that context. Mm.
And what I see in the Matthew 23 through Jesus is that love does involve judgment because presumably it's about justice and saying no to things that are not life-giving and are death-dealing. Mm. So it can be a hard thing. Well, it is a hard thing.
And here, I mean, here the way the author of 1 John talks about it, is, you know, this is a father, this is love that has been shown by sending a son. Mm. And also we get this family imagery here of a fatherly God or a parent God, if you want to use gender neutral language, who has made everyone children of God. Mm. So there's an action there of, you know, regardless of biology and ethnicity, everyone is made a child of God.
Yes.
It's the way this love works. So we get something about the nature of what this love should look like.
Yes. Mm. You actually mentioned one point, Robin. It's quite interesting because if I, again, allow me to be a bit jumpy, jumping back to the Pentecostal 22 set of lectionary reading in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2.
Yes.
Paul talks about how he, now, there's no word there about love at all. It's, you know, you can't find any word you know, for love. But he describes how he treats the community. And he talks about being like a parent. And I think, you know, it's quite interesting when you mention about 1 John, you know, the fatherly love and as an example. And this is another good example. Even without mentioning the word love, Paul sets an example. And love can be fulfilled in this way, in talking about how he nurtures a community, how he approaching the community. And of course, the teaching itself is quite consistent with what Frank said. You know, love is not just, you know, being warm and fussy and just good. Sometimes, you know, there are so many imperatives, commands in 1 Thessalonians, reminding there are things that we need to be careful of. And sometimes, you know, people need to hear the hard truth, so to speak.
And Paul, of course, I think we mentioned this last week, if you want to, again, balance some of these images for a parental God, Paul uses quite feminine images in the, in his nurturing, feeding, nursing. So, you know, you could pair these texts, even though the lectionary doesn't, if you wanted to unpack that image. If one's preaching for All Saints, it strikes me too that this John 3 reading, it's only a few verses, but I like how there's some mystery here. This author is not trying to tell us what heaven or the future or the eternal life is like. But there's just the promise that we don't know, but we know that when it's revealed, it will be like whatever Jesus is like. So, you know, in it's that, you know, classic idea of Jesus's first fruit. So we don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but Jesus has been there and done that for us, and we know that whatever Jesus' resurrection looks like, ours will be, as equally as children of God, ours will be part of that. I think that's where the children of God meets the resurrection promise.
And the communion of saints idea too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which might take us to Revelation.
Yeah, I was hoping it would.
Because we're going to run out of time. So for those preaching All Saints, the gospel reading is the Beatitudes from Matthew 5, which we're not going to discuss today, but we recorded a whole podcast on that passage back in January. It's episode 111, where we had Sally Douglas, a New Testament scholar, unpack that passage with us. So you can go listen to that if you want to know more about that.
So with the revelation, Robin, I feel like it'd be really good to lay out some fairly what you would see as basic parameters. There's language of angels and elders here. What's going on? And can you say what they're not, these angels and these elders?
Yes. So we're at a part of Revelation where we've had almost the first series of judgments. Judgments come in sevens. Yep. And this is between the sixth and the seventh. And the perspective shifts in this text. So the judgments are happening on earth, but this is a scene that takes us back up to what is really a heavenly court in Revelation. Mm-hmm. So the throne of God is central, and around that throne are elders who are resurrected humans. There's 24 of them, we're told, which I think represents the 12 tribes of Israel as well as the 12 apostles. So it's a symbolic way to say both Jesus' followers and the traditional tribes of Israel are in this heavenly court with God.
Which has echoes of communion of saints again for me.
Yes, definitely. I think if we're using saints in that more Protestant way of faithful
raising. That is how I mean it.
No, I know you do, but just to clarify for readers who might be thinking, are these all technical saints?
No.
Yes, I think the the elders are really key for us as human readers because they are future us. This is the communion of saints. And then there are also angels, and then there's some bizarre creatures. These are both non-human characters. So all the angelic hosts are around the throne worshipping God, and then there are these hybrid animalistic creatures, which I think represent creation, but, you know, it's a bit fantastical at that mm-hmm. point. So in this scene, we're taken up to the heavenly realm and we see a multitude. It's enormous and the breadth of it is incredible. I think this is a scene of great hope and comfort in terms of every tribe, nation and language is around this throne. Mm. So if we want a vision of what the church could and should look like, this is an intercultural, dynamic, diverse gathering of humanity.
Mm. As is the Acts 1 in Pentecost.
Yes, yes. And they are those that have been resurrected. They're the ones who, and there's great comfort here, the nature of this community and the way they're talked about in terms of the promises. So we have to read their promise that they won't hunger and thirst, their promise that God will wipe the tear from their eye. And the implication of that is they are people who hungered and thirst. They are people who wept, which is why the pairing with the Beatitudes works. They are people who were persecuted. And God is now offering them this place of comfort where they are satisfied, where they are fed. So there is a sense that this community of saints has also experienced struggling and hardship.
In a way, it's very helpful because sometimes we fail to acknowledge the current pain. Sometimes people are just talking about the future and just overlooking all the things and just, oh, it's okay. But it's not okay. You know, people are suffering at the moment. I think the lovely part about this passage is acknowledge it, but also offering a bit of hope. You know, it's not just about, all pain and suffering, but there is hope. But I think this is a good balance to include the two sides together in one text.
Well, I think that's probably a perfect way to end, Sunny. So we're out of time, unfortunately. But thank you so much for taking the time to join the conversation today at By the Well. Thanks for listening, folks.
Thank you. Thank you, Frank, and thank you, Robin.